The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. And today, we're taking a look at the actual printed Oprah Magazine. The first article is Here We Go. The gift of life also comes with the inevitable, aging. And I'm not talking about the obvious part of accruing years. I'm talking about how our mind and body metabolize those years. It's hard to know how much the process is really under our control, but I believe our view and approach can shape how it all unfolds. I also stand by the notation that we can get better as we age, acknowledging the pieces of the puzzle that make us who we are with greater clarity and becoming unapologetic about each one. Having just celebrated my 69th birthday, I'm taking stock of the changes I've been making to prioritize my health. In this issue, we offer helpful information for you to make some improvements, too. Peter Attia, MD, shares his thoughts on how we should diversify your fitness routines now to address the gravitational pull of aging in our later years. Our complexions need proactive love, too, and dermatologists ante up practical advice. Of course, beauty runs deep within the skin's surface, and it can be a journey for us to unconditionally embrace what we see in the mirror. Former creative director of J. Crew, Jenna Lyons, talks about hers. We also hear the unique things six writers find beautiful. I've always found beauty in books, and I'm happy to say we're on the 100th book of our book club, and it's aptly named Hello Beautiful. To me, there isn't another activity to replace the experience of a good read. It nourishes me from the inside out. As you take in this issue, I hope it does the same for you. It's time for us to age, not just gracefully, but intentionally. And I'm ready for it. Read on. Oprah. Our first article is by The Skin of My Teeth. Jenna Lyons is a fashion megaforce and a beauty entrepreneur with a big secret. She spent her whole life trying not to feel like an ugly outsider. As a teenager in Southern California in the 80s, Jenna Lyons felt like the furthest thing from a beach babe. Born with a rare genetic disorder that impaired her hair, skin, and teeth, she endured bullying at school and indifference at home. Today, the former creative director of J. Crew, founder of faux lashes brand Love Scene, and least housewifey Real Housewife of New York City, season 14 premieres this fall, is the picture of easy swagger and cool, but she's the first to admit that she was shaped by the trauma of her early years when she never, ever smiled. I was in third or fourth grade, sitting at a school assembly, when I heard some girls whispering behind me. I couldn't hear exactly what they were saying, but they were snickering and saying stuff like, "Bald," and "Why does she have that spot?" I wasn't even sure they were talking about me, but at home, after school, I got a mirror and angled it so I could see the back of my head. I remember my mom had put my hair in pigtails that day, and that's when I saw that I had a massive bald spot right in the back of my head. I burst into tears. I was like, what is going on? I was diagnosed at 7 months with a rare genetic disorder called incontinentia pigmenti, which affects your skin, teeth, and hair. Some people with IP are missing fingernails. Some people have neurological damage. I have bald spots, scarred, and hyperpigmented skin, especially behind my knees and under my arms, and almost no eyebrows or eyelashes. Maybe, worst of all, are my teeth. Until 10th grade, when I had veneers bonded onto them, I only had about 13 very small, cone-shaped teeth and huge gaps in the rest of my mouth. The crazy thing is, my parents had never told me anything about my condition. Until that school assembly, I had no idea I was different from anyone else. My mom, who passed away last September, had pretty severe Asperger's and had trouble forming emotional connections. That day she told me about my disorder, and then we basically never talked about it again. Her attitude was essentially, well, who cares about your appearance? Nobody cares. I think you're beautiful, and it's not relevant. My dad didn't talk about it either, and anyway, he left our family when I was 10. I guess if I had older siblings, I would have known I was different, but I didn't. I just had a younger brother. Of course, I cared about what I looked like, and kids at school noticed, but because my mom didn't have that mechanism for empathy, she basically ignored my condition. I definitely got teased and beaten up at school, though nobody called it bullying back then. I remember this one boy would chase and punch me. He was always waiting to get me on my way home after school. Thank God I was tall and a pretty fast runner. It was scary. My mother even called the school to complain, but they never did anything. All this did a number on me emotionally, and it was only later in my life that I started to undo some of it. For one, I became a pathological liar. I would make up stories to make myself interesting. I'd say that I was moving to France or that I was learning how to fly, things I thought would make me seem cool. Because my mom had no friends either, I really had no roadmap for what friendships looked like. Aside from my hair, skin, and teeth issues, I was also 6 feet tall by the time I was 13. My dad was 6'7", and my grandfather was also very tall. I'll never forget the humiliation of the seventh grade dance, literally being the last girl standing. That same year, my grandmother gave me a sewing machine and a subscription to Vogue for Christmas. Soon, my only ambition was to become a fashion designer. Moving to New York to attend Parsons School of Design was life-changing. Lyon's first job out of Parsons was assistant menswear designer at J. Crew. By 2008, she was the brand's creative director, and in 2010, its president. As I became known for my work with J. Crew, I started to get photographed. If you look at some early pictures, they're terrible. I was trying different looks, but I always looked awkward. At a certain point, I told myself, I need to rein it in. I started wearing my hair slicked back because it was easier, and wearing progressive lenses because I was constantly losing my glasses every time I had to take them on and off. This combination of hair and heavy black-rimmed glasses became my go-to look, and I noticed that in pictures I looked cleaner and less disheveled. The glasses even hid the scarring above my left eye, where my skin is sort of rippling from IP. And then one day a makeup artist put red lipstick on me. I have big, nice lips, thank God. And I remember seeing that one picture and thinking, I actually look okay. My teeth had definitely been my longest and most torturous journey. I remember sitting in my office 7 years ago when a colleague said to me, I think you have lipstick on your teeth. And I realized it wasn't lipstick, it was blood. You see, when I had my teeth bonded in high school, it wasn't done very well because we couldn't afford a top dentist. There was too much pressure put on the few teeth I had, so over time the roots were starting to die and that allowed for an abscess to form. At this point, I went to see a dentist in New York, Dr. Marion Brown, who basically told me, your teeth are failing and they're going to fall out. We cannot save them. You have two choices. You can either get dentures or go for massive reconstructive with implants. The problem with dentures is that in order to put them in, I would have had to remove the rest of my teeth and my face would most likely start to collapse. Health insurance would have paid for dentures, but that's not what I wanted to do. I had always been told I couldn't get implants because I didn't have enough bone in my jaw to secure them. But Dr. Brown told me, we can do this. It's just going to take a while. And she brought in two implant specialists from her practice, Dr. Dennis Tarnow and Dr. Guido Sarnicerio. My upper teeth were the most complicated because my upper jawbone had completely recessed, especially on the left side. My nose was slowly collapsing because of the lack of bone, so before we could do the implants, I needed to have my sinuses lifted and a series of bone grafts to build up my jawbone. It was only after I had built up enough bone that I was able to get the implants, and after that, the upper teeth you see now, which are all fake, they are essentially a permanent bridge on implants. As for my bottom teeth, I only just started on that journey. The teeth there are basically what I've had since 10th grade, including a retainer on the left side that's attached to partial dentures attached to my remaining three teeth. I had implants put in 2 years ago, but we had to take them out because something wasn't right. We did a bone graft, and just before Christmas, I had four new implants put in that seemed to be holding. I've had 14 oral surgeries so far. What we originally thought was going to take 2.5 to 3 years just to do the upper teeth has taken 6 years. I literally could have bought a house with what these teeth cost me, and I still have a way to go. Eating will be easier once it's all done. For instance, I still can't really eat a sandwich. My lack of eyelashes was obviously less of a big deal. But when eyelash extensions first became a thing in the U.S. around 2005, I remember going into a salon, lying down on the bed, and the technician telling me, "Yeah, I don't think you're a good candidate." I didn't have enough lashes to extend. Even when I was being photographed frequently, I didn't wear false eyelashes because they were insane looking over the top and heavy. Interestingly, the very first time I think I wore fake lashes was when I went on the Oprah show about 15 years ago. I was backstage with my makeup artist, Troy Oliveri, and Oprah came into the green room. She seemed larger than life, with so much energy and confidence that I felt overwhelmed. There was just a wave of energy that came through, and I was like, "Oh my God, I'm going to look like a wet rat next to her," Troy said. "Girl, get back in that chair, and I'm putting the extensions in, and I'm giving you lashes." And I was like, "Okay." Troy is the makeup artist I started my lashes company with. "Listen, I'm more comfortable with myself than I used to be. I'm definitely better, but I'm just as insecure as the next person, and there are a lot of things I still hide. For instance, I don't show a lot of skin because the camera magnifies the hyperpigmentation and contrast in my skin. I also have my mother's legs. My mother had these elephant-looking legs with no shape, and I have them too, and cellulite. I've had cellulite on the front and inside of my legs since I was 18. This is why I've never worn a short skirt, and I don't wear shorts. But at the same time, I know that photographers can easily retouch these things, like the scar above my eye, which has become more pronounced with age. To this day, friendship is still hard for me. I don't have a huge network of friends because I never learned how to do it. Being on this weird show has amplified that 100%. I often know that a lot of the people in my life either work for me or are in service in some way, and I pay them. I won't ask people to do things with me because I'm so afraid that they'll say no. It's a holdover from those days of rejection. I just assume people don't want to be with me, and the only way I know if they really do is if they seek me out. So I hang back, which can make me aloof. It makes me seem aloof. It's something I've struggled with my entire life. When it comes to self-acceptance about how we look, I think the culture is deeply divided. You have someone like Lizzo who is celebrated and celebrating herself. Then on the flip side, you have this whole Instagram culture and all these young women getting plastic surgery. It's a pretty divided space. Everyone I know is shot up and plumped up, and though I'm not against it, there's a limit to where I'll go. I don't want to lose myself in the process. After my mom died last fall, my brother and I were going through childhood photos, and I have to say, looking at them and seeing that version of myself, I felt sad remembering how it felt to look in the mirror and not feel great. When people ask me, "Does it bother you when someone comes up to you to ask you for a photo?" I'm like, "Are you kidding me? I'm so grateful. The idea that someone wants to be in a picture with me is the biggest compliment on the whole planet. It never bothers me. I'm flattered. I'm happy to have a picture. Always." This next article is The Truth About Inflammation. This chronic condition can have a not-so-great impact on your skin. Here's what you need to know about it. From turmeric to infrared spas, fighting inflammation has become the buzzy thing to do, and with good reason. Research has shown that chronic inflammation may lead to some pretty serious health conditions, including cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and more. But what exactly is inflammation? Simply put, it's the body's natural defense against tissue damage, potential toxins, bacteria, and viruses. When your body is faced with one of these things, it triggers your immune system to send inflammatory cells to start the healing process. This is good if you're injured or sick, but some things like poor diet or environmental factors can cause inflammation when your body doesn't actually need it. One of the nasty side effects of inflammation is accelerated aging of the skin, a phenomenon that is known as inflammaging. Barbara Sturm, that's S-T-U-R-M, founder of the beloved skincare line, Dr. Barbara Sturm Molecular Cosmetics, has spent decades studying this very thing. Sturm started her career in orthopedics, helping to create cutting-edge treatments for inflammatory conditions, like osteoarthritis. Inspired by her own skin issues, she began to focus on aesthetics, specifically how inflammation accelerates the process of aging. For Sturm, understanding and mitigating inflammation as you age is key to maintaining healthy skin. As we age, skin naturally slows down its cell turnover, meaning it becomes more difficult for our skin to recover from inflammatory triggers, she says. The result? An increase in fine lines, wrinkles, and more. Here, Sturm explains the concept of inflammation and how to prevent it. What are the effects of inflammation on skin? Inflammation is the body's response to irritation and injury and a primary trigger for visible signs of aging, as well as other skin conditions like acne, redness, enlarged pores, and skin diseases and dysfunctions, including psoriasis, rosacea, and perioral dermatitis. What are the most common causes of inflammation? We are bombarded every day with inflammatory influences, from harsh skincare ingredients to UVA and UVB rays, stress, tailpipe emissions, HEV, which stands for high energy visible, lights, smoking, drinking, and sugar. If we learn what the inflammatory and anti-inflammatory influences are, we can adjust our lifestyle accordingly. It will have both an immediate and a long-term effect on skin aging and your overall health. What is your top advice for women as they age? My number one piece of advice for anyone with aging skin is to try to adopt an anti-inflammatory lifestyle. Getting inflammation under control is essential for body and skin health. It's defined by getting enough sleep, early bedtimes, enjoying an anti-inflammatory diet, reducing stress and alcohol, and avoid unprotected exposures to UV rays, HEV light, and pollution. It's not hard to do once you know how. Personally, I try more every single day, even if it's just for 20 or 30 minutes, get a good night's sleep. I'm usually in bed by 9 p.m., and I rarely drink alcohol. I follow an anti-inflammatory diet, but there's balance. I can't resist a dessert here and there. When it comes to an anti-inflammatory diet, are there particular foods you recommend? I recommend eating a diet rich in fatty fish, avocados, broccoli, and green leafy vegetables, and avoiding inflammatory substances such as alcohol, sugar, excessive salt, and processed or fried foods. Many of your products contain purslane. And why is this such a good ingredient for inflammation? Purslane is an herbal ingredient packed full of anti-inflammatory nutrients and antioxidants such as omega-3 fatty acids and skin beneficial minerals like calcium, magnesium, and potassium. It's known to be a telomerase activator, an enzyme capable of creating new protective ends on cellular chromosomes called telomeres. Purslane works both topically and orally, which is why we use it in our skincare products and our supplements to give you the ultimate inside-out and top-to-bottom anti-aging result. Okay, along with this article is a find the right inflammation-fighting product for you. And according to Sturm, your basic inflammation-busting routine should start with a good cleanser and a face cream and be built upon according to what your skin needs. Here, her can't-miss product recs for different skin types. Dry skin. Hyaluronic acid is a powerful humectant for your skin. Look for a high concentrate of blended low and high molecular weight hyaluronic molecules, as in my hyaluronic serum, to hydrate superficially and at deeper skin levels. Blemish-prone skin. Zinc is a must for blemish-prone skin due to its anti-inflammatory, antibacterial, and sebum-suppressing effects. My Clarifying Mask 1 pairs zinc with balloon vine and viper's bug lust to help balance the skin's pH levels and improve its barrier function. Sensitive skin. All my products are for sensitive skin, no exceptions. I use healing and biomimetic ingredients, not aggressive ones. I invented my calming serum specifically to quell irritation using a plant-based complex of cardiospermum, echium, and sunflower seed oil. Oily skin. Tea tree oil is an amazing ingredient for oily skin because it has antiseptic and antibacterial properties. You'll often find it in products that cater to oily skin types, including some in my clarifying collection. Darker skin tones. Skin with more active melanocytes has a greater susceptibility to inflammation and its consequences, like post-inflammation hyperpigmentation. Lumiocol lightens to hyperpigmentation and helps even out skin tone. It's a key ingredient in my darker skin tones collection, too, which includes foam, cleanser, enzyme cleanser, hyaluronic serum, face cream, and face cream rich. The next article is Short Hair at a Certain Age. To chop or not to chop? Dee Dee Gluck navigates the cultural baggage. "It's only hair," I exclaimed defiantly, while cutting my own bangs with nail scissors the night before my wedding. "You can't be too precious about it," I explained to my kids after getting a pixie cut on a whim while they were at school. "Your hair is your greatest accessory. Play with it." I've written throughout my career as a beauty editor, and I've practiced what I've preached, being the proud owner of not just the aforementioned pixie, but many other short styles. A mullet, a blunt bob, a wolf cut, and yes, even a Dorothy Hamill wedge, long after she won gold. But here I find myself at 52, letting my signature short hair grow to shoulder length. At 25, a pixie was bold, edgy, sexy. Then something happened, and I took a nosedive into middle age. Short hair started to feel boring, expected, and dare I say it, coastal grandma. I blame the old tropes, the ones I thought I was immune to. Cutting your hair is like publicly reassigning from your sex life. Short hair is mannish. You'll look like a golden girl. I'd never listened to that hot garbage before, so why would I when I'm old enough to know better? Possibly because now that I am in my 50s and my kids are older, society treats me like the invisible woman, and I'm holding on to every last strand to call attention to the fact that I'm still here. The irony is that going shorter may actually be the sexier move as the years tick on. Most of us don't have the same hair we did at 20, thick, shiny, and bouncy, says Adir Abergel, the master stylist who has worked with short-haired celebs, including Charlize Theron, Cate Blanchett, and Jennifer Garner, now the owner of a cute lob. Hair ages, it gets drier, growth slows, and the strands we do have tend to fall out more easily. The right chop can make it look much healthier and fuller, and fortunately, the shortcuts of today do not require a weekly wash and set at the salon that resulted in the ubiquitous Golden Girls poof. Just look to Robin Wright, Annette Bening, or Jamie Lee Curtis, says celebrity hairstylist Tommy Bucket. He's right. They have sex appeal coming out of their ears. The key to these successful styles, says Tiffany Kalijic, the owner of La Apparetainment Hair Boudoir in New York City, is soft layers around the face and the nape of the neck, which flatter skin that doesn't quite drape like it used to, and hair that doesn't quite grow like it used to. Still, while I get all the rational arguments for why now may, in fact, be the best time for a woman of my age to go short, I've never been that rational. Need proof? Look at how they bang trim worked out in my wedding album. I just can't bring myself to go Audrey, Tautou, or Hepburn. Again, instead, I'm contemplating a choppy, just above the shoulders length shag. In a way, it feels like the best way to honor this life stage. Neither here nor there, neither old nor young, much like midlife itself. Our next article is In Pursuit of Perfection. To make peace with aging, writer and actor Jenny Molin suggests we savor the present rather than long for the past. I recently found myself uptown at a fancy plastic surgeon's office asking if I should have an upper blepharoplasty. That's where they trim the excess skin off your eyelid so it doesn't sag down over your pupil, making you look like a bull mastiff. My mother always warned that as I grew older, my lids would be the first things to fall. And trimming my blefs was something I'd anticipated tackling head-on, or rather eyes open, with a light anesthetic when I hit 40. Now, at 43, I felt like a radical for having waited so long. I grew up with a fitness-obsessed father and a Malibu Barbie mom who had prioritized their youth and beauty above all else. There was never any stigma around getting work done or killing themselves in the gym for a six-pack. Maintaining my physical appearance has always seemed obligatory, something I had to put effort into if I wanted to succeed at life and remain my father's favorite. My first brush with fame was a newspaper article in the Arizona Republic at 6 months old, where my marathon runner parents proudly described how they had me eating a low-protein diet and doing baby calisthenics to set me up for future success. I think there was even a photo of me doing an army crawl. Despite my predetermined destiny, I've tried to be thoughtful about my approach to aging. Not because I'm any less vain than my parents, but because I know that regardless of my choice in skincare, eventually even Malibu Barbies turn into California raisins. I don't want to grow old. Nobody does. But there's no getting out of here alive. Like adorable little chicks on a conveyor belt heading toward a high-speed grinder, we all end up somebody else's collagen cream. So do we nip it? Tuck it, or just say, no. Perhaps the only way to win it, to savor the present instead of longing for the past, Time stands still for no one. I guess I just like to look frozen in time, but like frozen 4 years ago, I told the nurse during my intake. I shrugged. Have you had any other surgeries? She looked at me dubious. No. I shook my head, admitting the breast augmentation I had at 22, the lower blepharoplasty I had at 28, and the breast lift I had at 41. It wasn't that I wanted her to think my boobs were real. It was more that her questions felt irrelevant and like information that could be used against me at a later date. The truth was that I'd been tweaking since the early aughts, and I had no plans to stop. While my goal wasn't to look like a sexy baby, I wouldn't have minded being mistaken for that baby's au pair. After several more minutes of cat and mouse, where she tricked me into revealing my two C-sections and an impacted wisdom tooth removal, the nurse asked me to stand up so that she could take several digital photographs of my face. The doctor will be in shortly, she said, straight to my boobs, to let me know she'd already figured out that they were fake. The doctor, a salt and peppered man in his 50s, with a cherub face and wide-set eyes, entered the room, plopped himself down on a swivel chair next to me, and asked me what I thought was wrong with my eyes. I admitted that I wasn't entirely sure, but wanted his opinion nonetheless. I explained to him that several of my girlfriends had recently been in for the same procedure, mentioning their full names just to have that awkward back and forth where he pretends not to know who I'm talking about and keep assuring him that he can drop the act. Kelly Jervik, she literally asked if she could drive me here. I doubled down. After reminding me a few more times of his doctor's patient confidentiality clause, he looked at me kindly, then told me to get out of his office. Is this about Kelly? I asked. I know she can be polarizing. He shook his head. You don't need your eyes done. You'd be crazy to start messing with your face, and if you do, you'll regret it for the rest of your life. Is that all? I laughed. You know who you look like? My high school girlfriend. Currently? I gulped, certain he was at least 10 years older than me. Not currently. I just mean you have that girl next door thing. You're natural, he said, glancing at my form to double check. But you are also the kind of person who ends up making a huge mistake with her looks. Somebody's going to get in your head, and you're going to end up doing something you can't reverse. I felt like I was 37 again and back in Hong Kong, where a fortune teller read my face and prophesied that I'd work my entire life but never make any money. I remember pleading with my translator to inform the reader that he wasn't seeing the real me. Any line worth reading on my forehead had been frozen with Botox. I'm not going to do anything stupid, I promised him as he stood to go. I'll tell you when it's time to cut, but just remember that once you start, you can't go back. The door slammed shut as his words fell heavy on my moderately sagging eyelids. I wondered if I'd have to go ego strength to heed his advice, or if I'd succumb to my preordained fate and do something I'd later regret. In a society where youth has always been a currency, we are all tragic heroes fighting against insurmountable odds. Our grandparents aged gracefully, not because they lacked vanity, but because the only thing they could use to hold up their faces was tape. Back then, a person's wellness routine was simply an apple a day, followed by a T-bone steak and 7 packs of cigarettes. Today, our choices are endless. Potions and procedures promising not just prepubescent pores, but photoshopped perfection accost us at every turn. Social media has given us the power to create the mythology of our own aging. With a swipe of a finger, we can filter our flaws, cinch our waists, contour our cheekbones, and stay looking forever 21. But trying to embody this unrealistic beauty standard is as absurd as trying to fit into a too-tight piece of fast fashion. I don't want to look like Madonna. I don't want to spend the rest of my life desperately seeking surgery or hearing people say, "Who's that girl?" when I walk past. I just want to wear spaghetti straps without a bra. I want to get warnings instead of speeding tickets. I want people to fall out of their chairs when they learn that I'm a mother of two, and I want my Barry's Boot Camp instructor to straddle me when I'm doing a bench press. I want the respect of being over 40, but the power of being under 30. I want it all, the way every Hollywood rom-com promises. I want to be a mother of three, but also the CEO of my own company, a woman who has time for dry brushing and pedicures and date nights with her Armani model husband who is excited to see her every time she walks in the room. I spent the years my body will ever see in a velour tracksuit only to reach my 40s and learn that black tie now means a bikini covered in full-length fishnet. It's not fair. But despite the surgeries, facials, lasers, and fillers, nothing has changed the way I feel about being older. It's both bittersweet and infuriating. I always dreamed of a day when my son would be embarrassed, his friends considered me hot, but that's not something any surgeon can provide. That only happens when we have babies at 15. I'm starting to accept that no matter what I do to myself at 43, my body will still turn 44, even if my implants are under 18. As the people around us start looking more and more like their iPhone emojis, perhaps the biggest act of rebellion is to do nothing. But I'm too big a narcissist for that. What we need as a culture is group therapy and transparency, people talking about how maddening it feels to be out of control. We need to fill our world with sticky notes reminding us what is real. Regardless of your current age, you are never going to be younger than you are right now. See, you just aged a second. So stop deleting pictures of yourself that you don't like, because 10 years from now, even a bad pic of you is a good one. And while you're at it, stop beating yourself up for being human. Life is happening, and unlike your forehead, you can't make it stand still. Portions of that article were edited for time. So the Oprah magazine provides some recipes. This first one is party on a platter. To celebrate mom, dad, or just the thrill of warmer days, whip up this menu from superstar chef Yotam Ottolenghi. And for a splash of white lotus chic, why not serve it all on a colorful dishes like the ones designed by the dream host himself. The main event, the bright red puttanesca-inspired oil, makes this recipe a spectacular centerpiece, says Ottolenghi. And the lemony salsa is a perfect sidekick for the fish's richness. So this is called Puttanesca Esque, that's Esque, baked salmon with olives and caper salsa. The ingredients for the salmon are 4.5 tablespoons of olive oil, 8 anchovy fillets finely chopped, 2.5 tablespoons of tomato paste, 1/2 teaspoon of red chili flakes, 2 teaspoons of coriander seeds lightly crushed, 8 cloves of garlic very thinly sliced, 2 preserved lemons, fresh scooped out and discarded, rind finely chopped, about 2 ounces, 2 teaspoons of pure maple syrup, 1 large lemon sliced, 1 2.5-pound skin-on salmon fillet, pin bones removed, salt and pepper, 8 ounces grape or cherry tomatoes halved. For the salsa, it's 1/4 pitted Kalamata olives, scant 1/2 cup, 1/2 cup of small capers, for regular capers, roughly chopped, 1 preserved lemon, flesh scooped out and discarded, rind thinly sliced, about 1 ounce. 1.5 cups of basil leaves, roughly chopped. 3/4 cup parsley leaves, roughly chopped. 2 tablespoons of olive oil. 2 teaspoons of fresh lemon juice. Kosher salt and pepper. Baby arugula for serving. Number 1. Cook the salmon. In a small skillet, combine oil, anchovies, and tomato paste and cook on medium, stirring occasionally 5 minutes. Number 2. Stir in chili flakes and coriander seeds and cook until fragrant, 1 minute. Remove from heat and stir in garlic, preserved lemons, and maple syrup to combine. Let cool 15 minutes. Number 3. Meanwhile, heat the oven to 350 degrees. Line large-rimmed baking sheet with parchment paper and arrange lemon slices in a single layer in the center. Season salmon with 1/8 teaspoon salt and 1/2 teaspoon pepper and arrange skin side down over lemon slices. Number 4. Scatter tomatoes around the salmon. Pour the cooked oil and its solids over salmon, pressing garlic slices flat against the top of the salmon. Roast until barely opaque throughout, 17 to 20 minutes, depending on thickness and desired doneness. Remove from the oven and let sit 5 minutes before transferring salmon, tomatoes, and lemon to platter. Number 5. Meanwhile, prepare salsa. In a small bowl, combine olives, capers, preserved lemon, basil, parsley oil, and lemon juice together with 1/8 teaspoon of salt and pepper and mix well. Scatter 1/2 of salsa over salmon. Serve warm or at room temperature with remaining salsa and arugula if desired, and it serves 6 to 8 people. Our next article is entitled Finish Strong. To stay fit and vibrant for decades to come, follow a longevity doctor's orders. Make a wish list of 10 activities you'd like to kick butt at when you're 100 and gear your workouts to all of them now. When I talk with my patients about exercise, I often tell them the story of Sophie, my friend Becky's mother, who died of respiratory illness at age 83. When I flew to San Francisco to attend the funeral, I hadn't seen Sophie in 15 years. I remembered her as a vibrant, athletic woman who seemed ageless. She had been relatively active even in retirement. She played golf and worked most days in her garden. It wasn't a structured exercise program. She was just doing the things she loved. But then she injured her shoulder and then her knee, requiring surgery for both. After surgery, her activity level dropped off almost to zero. As Becky related to me, her mother mostly sat around the house depressed. Her cognitive decline quickly ensued. This made me incredibly sad as I sat there in the pew at her funeral. Yet her story was all too familiar. We have all seen older friends and relatives go through a similar ordeal, slowly, or not slowly, weakening until they can no longer find enjoyment in the things they once loved to do. What could have been done, I wondered, to change Sophie's fate? Had she simply needed to exercise more, go to the gym and use the elliptical? Would that have saved her somehow? It wasn't clear that the answer was that simple. I had done plenty of exercise in my own life, but by the time of Sophie's funeral, I was nursing a handful of pet injuries that I'd accumulated over the years. Fit as I was, it wasn't clear that I was on a better path. For most of my life, I've been obsessive with respect to fitness, always focusing on one particular sport and inevitably taking it to an extreme. After I burned myself out on boxing, then running, then long-distance open-water swimming, I turned to cycling. I went all in. My primary aim in life was to win the local cycling time trial series, a 20-kilometer individual race against the clock that almost nobody else cared about. I spent hours analyzing power meter data and calculating my coefficient of aerodynamic drag, looking to shave precious seconds from my times using dorky models that I'd built in Excel. The truth was that I had become pretty useless at everything except pedaling my road bike as fast as possible for 20 kilometers. I possessed a high VO2 max, the maximum rate at which a person can utilize oxygen, and perhaps the single most powerful marker for longevity, and I could produce a lot of power through the pedals. But I was not truly strong or flexible, and I did not have great balance or stability. I was a one-dimensional athlete, and if I'd kept it up, I might have ended up with my spine fused into my time trial luck, still able to ride my bike but unable to do anything else useful, especially with my upper body. I eventually quit competitive cycling because it became clear that at a certain point this obsessive approach becomes unsustainable in virtually any activity. How many old marathon runners do you know who are still racing? Probably not many. After that, I fell into a limbo where I bounced around between different activities. I tried to get back into running. I went to Pilates class with my wife. I did Barry's boot camp for a time. You name it, I tried it. And then I joined a boutique fitness chain that specializes in high-intensity interval training, or HIIT. I enjoyed the fast-paced workouts they offered, like treadmill sprints and 30-second burpee blocks, and it took a fraction of the time that cycling did, so I was happy about that. But I didn't have a goal other than exercising. All this changed as I sat in the church at Sophie's funeral. Officially, she died of pneumonia, but what had really killed her, I realized, was the slow gravitational pull of aging on her body. That had not begun in the last year or even the last decade of her life. It had been working against her, pulling her down since before I had met her, for decades. And it was killing the rest of us, too. Her daughter, Becky, my patients, myself, and everyone reading this is likely headed for the same steep decline. That thought saddened me to my core, and then it hit me. The only way that we would be able to fight this was to adopt the philosophy of a decathlete and apply it to aging. Of all Olympic athletes, the decathletes are most revered. The male and female winners of the gold medal are declared the world's greatest athletes. Yet they're not the best at any of the 10 individual events in which they compete. They likely would not even medal. They're considered the greatest because they are remarkably good at so many different events. They are true generalists, yet they train like specialists. We need to adopt a similar approach to aging, I decided. Each of us needs to be training for the centenarian decathlon. What in the world is the centenarian decathlon? I'm not talking about an actual competition among 100-year-olds, although similar events do already exist. The National Senior Games, held every other year, brings together remarkable older athletes, some of them in their 90s and beyond. The record for the 100-meter dash for women ages 100 and up is about 41 seconds. The Centenarian Decathlon is a framework I use to organize my patients' physical aspirations for the later decades of their lives, especially their marginal decades. I know, it's a somewhat morbid topic, thinking about our own physical decline, but not thinking about it won't make it any less inevitable. Think of the Centenarian Decathlon as the 10 most important physical tasks you will want to be able to do for the rest of your life. Some items on the list resemble actual athletic events, while some are closer to activities of daily living, and still others might reflect your own personal interests. I find it useful because it helps us visualize with great precision exactly what kind of fitness we need to build and maintain as we get older. It creates a template for our training. I start by presenting my patients with a long list of physical tasks that might include some of the following. Number 1, hike 1.5 miles on a hilly trail. Number 2, get up off the floor under your own power using a maximum of one arm for support. Number 3, pick up a young child from the floor. Number 4, carry 2 5-pound bags of groceries for 5 blocks. Number 5, lift a 20-pound suitcase into the overhead compartment of a plane. Number 6, balance on one leg for 30 seconds, eyes open. Bonus points, eyes closed for 15 seconds. Number 7, have sex. Number 8, climb 4 flights of stairs in 3 minutes. Number 9, open a jar. Number 10, do 30 consecutive jump rope skips. The full list is much longer, with more than 50 different items, but you get the idea. Once they've read it, I ask them to please select which of these tasks they want to be able to perform in their 9th, or better yet, 10th decade. Which ones do they choose? All of them, typically. They want to be able to hike 1.5 miles, or carry their own groceries, or pick up a great-grandchild, or get up if they fall down, or play 18 holes of golf, or open a jar, or fly somewhere on a plane. Of course they do. That's great, I say. You'll make that kid's day when you pick her up like that. But now let's do a little math. Let's say the kid weighs 25 or 30 pounds. That's basically the same as doing a squat while holding a 30-pound dumbbell in front of you. For example, a goblet squat. Can you do that now at age 40? Most likely, but now let's look into the future. Over the next 30 or 40 years, your muscle strength will decline by about 8 to 17% per decade. You're going to have to be able to lift 50 to 55 pounds now without hurting yourself. Can you do that? I press the issue. You also want to be able to hike on a hilly trail. To do that comfortably requires a VO2 max of roughly 30 mL/kg minutes. Let's take a look at the results of your latest VO2 max test. And guess what? You only scored a 30. You're average for your age, but I'm afraid that's not good enough because your VO2 max is also going to decline. You can pull it off now, but you likely won't be able to do it when you're older. On it goes. To lift a 20-pound suitcase overhead when you are older means lifting 40 or 50 pounds now. To be able to climb 4 flights of stairs in your 80s means you should be able to pretty much sprint up those same stairs today. In every case, you need to be doing much more now to armor yourself against the natural and precipitous decline in strength and aerobic capacity that you will undergo as you age. Eventually, my patients get it. Together, we come up with a list of 10 or 15 events in their personal centenarian decathlon representing their goals for their later decades. This then determines how they should be training in the end. Most people's centenarian decathlons will probably overlap to a degree. Someone who enjoys stand-up paddleboarding, for example, will perhaps choose events focused around building core and cross-body strength. But she will likely be training the same muscle groups as I'm doing for archery and maintaining a similar degree of stamina and balance. The centenarian decathlon is ambitious, no question. A 90-year-old who is able to board a plane under her own power, let alone hoist a carry-on bag, is doing extremely well. But there's a method to the madness. These individual tasks are not out of reach. There are octogenarians, non-agenarians, and even centenarians right now who are running marathons, racing bicycles, lifting weights, flying airplanes, jumping out of airplanes, skiing the Rocky Mountains, competing in actual decathlons, and doing all sorts of amazing things. So all these events are within the realm of possibility. One possibility of the centenarian decathlon, in fact, is to help us redefine what is possible in our later years and wipe away the default assumption that most people will be weak and incapable at that point in their lives. We need to abolish that decrepit stereotype and create a new narrative, perhaps modeled after the old school fitness guru Jack LaLanne, who kept doing his usual rigorous daily workouts right up until his death at age 96. Unlike most very long-lived individuals, he didn't just get there by accident or luck. He built and maintained a high level of fitness throughout his life, beginning in the 1930s when very few people exercised regularly and fitness centers did not yet exist. As he got older, he set out very deliberately to defy the stereotype of aging as a period of misery and decline. He did the work, and he succeeded, giving us a glimpse of what an older person is truly capable of achieving. If we are to follow in LaLanne's footsteps, we must stop pointlessly exercising just because we think we are supposed to, banging away on the elliptical trainer at lunch hour. I promise you can do better. I suggest you join me and start training with a very specific purpose, which is to kick butt 100-year-olds. When my patients say they are more interested in being kick butt 50-year-olds than centenarian decathletes, I reply that there is no better way to make that happen than to set a trajectory toward being vibrant at 100 or 90 or 80, just as an archer who trains at 100 years will be more accurate at 50. By fixing our aim on the centenarian decathlon, we can make every decade between now and then better as well. When the centenarian decathlon as my goal, I now work out with the focus that I once directed exclusively towards cycling, swimming, or boxing. It's not about being great at any one pursuit, but about being pretty good at just about everything. As centenarian decathletes, we are no longer training for a specific event, but to become a different sort of athlete altogether, an athlete of life. So we're now heading to Oprah's book club, introducing Hello Beautiful. This excerpt from the 100th Oprah's Book Club pick has it all. First love, nosy sisters, embarrassing dads, and a little poetry. Julia was in the back garden, an 18 by 16 foot rectangle hemmed by wooden fences, watching her mother dig up the last of the season's potatoes at the exact time William was due at the house. She knew he'd be punctual and that one of her sisters would let him in. William would probably be flustered by her father, who would ask him if he knew any poetry by heart, and by Emmeline and Cecilia, who wouldn't cease moving or talking. Sylvia was working at the library, so he'd be spared by inquisitive stare. A few minutes alone with her sisters and father would help William to get to know them. Julia wanted him to see how lovable they were, and as a bonus, he'd be extra thrilled to see her when she walked inside. Julia was famous within her family for making an entrance, which really just meant that she thought about timing, whereas no one else in her family did. As a young child, Julia would twirl into the kitchen or living room, calling out, "Ta-da!" What would William think of their small house squeezed in next to the identical squat brick house on 18th Place? The Potavanos lived in Pilsen, a working-class neighborhood filled with immigrants. Colorful murals adorned the sides of buildings, and in the local supermarket you were as likely to hear Spanish or Polish as English. Julia worried that William would find both the neighborhood and the inside of her family's home shabby, the floral couch covered in plastic. Julia shivered. She wasn't wearing a coat. It was 40 degrees out, and most Chicagoans refused to consider it cold until the temperature dropped below freezing. "I like him," she said to her mother's back. "Is he a drunk?" "No, he's a basketball player and an honors student. He's going to major in history." "Is he as smart as you?" Julia considered this. William was clearly smart. His brain worked. He asked questions that let her know he was interested in understanding her. His intelligence didn't register in the form of strong opinions, though. He was interested in questions and uncertain in his answers. He was moldable. William had studied with Julia a few times at the Lozano Library, which was only a few blocks away from the Potavanos' home. Sylvia worked at the library, and everyone in the neighborhood used it as a meeting place. But studying there meant that William had to commute an hour back to his dorm late at night. When making weekend plans, he always said, "Let's do whatever you want to do. You have the best ideas." Julia had never considered the ideas of physical intelligence until she attended William's recent basketball game. She was surprised about how exciting she found watching William compete with his team. She'd seen a more forceful side of him than he'd exhibited off the court. yelling commands to his teammates, using his strong, tall body to block an opponent from the basket. Julie had no interest in sports and didn't understand the rules, but her handsome boyfriend had sprinted and leapt and spun with such pure physicality and such intensity of focus that she had found herself thinking, yes. "He's a serious person," Julie said. "He takes life seriously like I do." Rose climbed to her feet. A stranger might have laughed at the sight of her, but Julie was accustomed to her mother's get-up. When she gardened, Rose wore a modified baseball catcher's uniform, topped off with a navy blue sombrero. She found all of it on the street. "It's just as well, I suppose. I'm smarter than your father by a million miles." Julia could see how smart was a tricky term. How did you quantify it, especially when neither of her parents had gone to college? But her mother was correct. Julia had seen photos of Rose, pretty and tidy and smiling in their same garden, with Charlie at the beginning of their marriage. But her mother had eventually accepted and donned marital disappointment. At the same way, she strapped on her ridiculous gardening outfit. All of her considerable efforts to propel her husband toward some kind of financial stability and success had died in their tracks. The sky was dimming and the air growing colder. When freezing temperatures arrived to stay, this neighborhood would quiet, but tonight it cluttered as if trying to get its final words. Distant kids shouted laughter. The older Mrs. Ciccioni warbled in her garden. A motorcycle coughed three times before starting up. "I suppose it's time to go inside," Rose said. "Are you embarrassed by your old lady looking like this?" "No," Julia said. She knew William's attention would be on her. She loved the hopeful look William directed at her, as if he were a ship eyeing the ideal harbor. William had grown up in a nice home, with a professional father, a big lawn, and his own bedroom. He clearly knew what success and security looked like, and the fact that he saw those possibilities in Julia pleased her immensely. Rose had tried to build a solid life, but Charlie had wandered away with or kicked over every stone she laid down. Julia had decided halfway through her first conversation with William that he was the man for her. He had everything she was looking for, and as she told her mother, she just really liked him. The sight of him made her smile, and she loved fitting her small hand inside his large one. They made an excellent team. William had experienced the kind of life Julia wanted, so he could direct her endless energy where they built their future together. Once she and William were married and established in their own home, she would help her family. Her solid foundation would extend to become theirs. She almost laughed out loud at the relief on her boyfriend's face when she entered the living room. William was seated next to her father on the squeaky couch, and Charlie had his hand on the young man's shoulder. Cecilia was lying across the old red armchair, and Emmeline was staring in the mirror hung beside the front door, adjusting her hair. Cecilia was saying in a serious voice, "You have an excellent nose, William." "Oh," William said, clearly surprised. "Thank you." Julia grinned. "Don't mind Cecilia. She talks that way because she's an artist." "Oh, you do have a nice nose," Emmeline said politely, because she'd noticed William blush and wanted to make him feel better. Emmeline read the emotional tenor of every room and wanted everyone to feel comfortable and content at all times. "He doesn't know a word of Whitman," Charlie said to Julia. "Can you imagine?"
"No one knows Whitman, except for you, Daddy," Cecilia said. The fact that William didn't know any of Walt Whitman's poems was additional validation for Julia that her boyfriend was different from her father. "I can reserve Leaves of Grass for you at the library if you'd like," Sylvia said to William. "It's worth reading." Julia hadn't noticed Sylvie, who stood in the doorway of the kitchen. She must have just gotten home from her shift at the library, and her lips were the kind of deep red that meant she'd been kissing one of her boys in the stacks. Sylvie was a senior in high school and spent her free hours working as many shifts as possible to save money for community college.
"Thank you," William said. "I'm afraid I haven't read much poetry at all."
Julie was sure William hadn't noticed her sister's lips, and even if he had, he wouldn't know what they meant. Sylvie was the sister Julia was closest to, and she was the only person who stymied Julia, who left her at a loss for words. Her sister had read hundreds of novels. It had been Sylvie's only interest and hobby for their entire lives, and out of those books she'd plucked a life goal, to have a great, once-in-a-century love affair. It was a child's dream, but Sylvie was still holding on to it with both hands. She was looking for him, her soulmate, every day of her life, and she made out with boys during her shifts in the library to practice for when she might meet him. "I suppose we should eat." Rose had come out of her bedroom, clean and wearing one of her nicer house dresses.
It's lovely to meet you, William. Do you like red wine?
He stood, unfolding his long body from the low couch, and he nodded.
Hello, ma'am.
Sweet Mother of Mary! Rose tripped her head back to look over at him. She was barely 5 feet tall. You didn't think to mention that he's a giant, Julia?
He's a marvel, though, isn't he? Charlie said. He's got our Julia soft around the edges, which I wouldn't have thought possible. Look at her smile.
Daddy, Julia said.
What position do you play? Charlie asked William. Small forward. Ha! If you're the small forward, I'd hate to be the big one.
I wonder what the evolutionary explanation is for that kind of height, Sylvie said. Do we need people who could peer over walls to see if the enemy was coming?
Everyone in the room, including William, laughed, and Julia thought he looked a little teary in the middle of the action. She made her way to him and whispered,
Are we too much for you?
He squeezed her hand, a gesture she understood meant both yes and no.
So we're in the reading room of the magazine, and these are some recommended books. Thrillers That Chill, My Husband by Maud Ventura. In this wry psychological complex debut, a meticulously manicured wife is obsessed with her husband. For the past 13 years, she made a science of meeting his needs, putting them before her own, or even their children's. Her love is a strange hold. Something's got to give. The winner of France's first novel prize, this riveting emotional thriller requires serious willpower to not devour in a single sitting. And again, that's called My Husband by Maud Ventura. Another one is called The Guest by Emma Klein. In this dark summer's tale by the author of The Girls, a 22-year-old girl named Alex lucks into a relationship with a civilian who invites her to spend August at his house in Long Island. When she crosses a line and he kicks her out, she drifts and grifts her way for another week, playing one person after another with her uncanny ability to seem like one of us. But her mistakes pile up and her plan has a major flaw. Again, that one's called The Guest by Emma Klein. Beware the Woman by Megan Abbott. On Michigan's remote Upper Peninsula, JC, 32, is feeling uneasy as her new husband, her father-in-law, and their friends being oddly overprotective of her pregnancy, almost as if they don't see her body as hers. Are they plotting something with this bewitchingly creepy tale thriller? Queen Megan Abbott keeps readers questioning whether this family getaway is the stuff of anxiety, dreams, of blue or bluebeard nightmares. Again, that's titled Beware the Woman, and it's by Megan Abbott. We have a love story, Meet Me at the Lake by Carly Fortune. At 32, Fern Brookbanks has escaped the family-owned resort on Lake Muskoka, where she grew up and has a dream of opening a coffee shop in Toronto. Then her mother suddenly dies, leaving Fern the resort, which comes complete with two former boyfriends involved in its management. One of them stood her up 10 years ago and has been on her mind ever since. This witty Canadian romance is an escapist pleasure. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.